Good evening, good evening. What's going on, Fair Trade Cafe? Woo! Yeah. Pretty sure we're like against code right now with as many people are in here. So look out for your neighbors. You know, if something happens, save yourselves. No. Awesome. Guys, this is the final Chatterbox show ever. Feels really weird to say. Feels weird to say it just like that. Oh. But I said it. I'm really glad that you're all here. I'm really excited about this lineup right now. We have some amazing storytellers, regulars that have been telling for a while at Chatterbox to send us out right. So I'm really excited that you all could be here tonight. This has been a really special community. You'll hear me blubber about it later. But I just want to jump right in and get us to our storytellers. So please put your phones on silent. If you do need some coffee, tip your baristas and don't order a fucking smoothie or I'll find you and I will murder your family. Oh, and for those of you who don't know, my name's Jesse. I'm the host and producer of this show. All right. All right, guys. So the rule is when I bring up storytellers, because there's so many of you, it's going to take a while for them to get up here. So you have to clap the entire time until they get to the microphone. Just so you guys know, that's how this works here. All right, our first storyteller, I've known her since our first location. She is inspiring, and I love her authenticity. Put your hands together for Nicole.
Okay, ready. I had to write it because it was really long. So if I go a little bit over, don't worry, I'm going to get it down. But I want to get my point across. So empowerment really comes down to who you know yourself to be. And that's our theme for tonight. So as a kid, a phrase I remember frequently hearing was, "Who do you think you are?" Rarely I allowed anyone, no matter the circumstance, to dictate to me what power I had in any given situation. For me, acceptance was someone else's opinion as fact, and that never had been okay with me, and that started from a very young age. From what I remember, being small, I would lay in my bed at night listening, and on one particular night, in accordance with my mom's recollection, I was maybe 2 or 3 years old. My dad was drunk, he was angry, and he was physically taking it out on my mom, which was a regular occurrence. Now, back in the 70s, it wasn't uncommon to watch TV shows where women were slapped around, pushed, and shoved. I mean, after all, we did have in the 80s Pat Benatar, who said, "Hit me with your best shot." If you're ever curious about that information, you should probably watch All in the Family. Now, I climbed out of my bed in horror as to what I was hearing, and I went down the stairs one by one, clutching the stair rail. And I came around the corner, and I saw my mom huddled with my dad wailing on her. Now, at 2 or 3, whatever age I was, I defended my mom with pee streaming down my leg, standing up against my father. And I'm sure in my limited capacity as a child to understand, I knew there would be repercussions of some sort, but it didn't matter. The gravity of the situation dictated action. And in the times in my life, I may have entertained the notion that I don't have the authority to change circumstance. Wasn't that what our school years were all about anyway? Yet I've been gifted many opportunities within my lifetime to buck the status quo, and I also have had plenty of opportunities to accept someone else's label and make it my own. And in my 20s, I was working in an environment with an extremely hostile boss who would come into work regularly drunk and would be verbally and somewhat physically abusive with throwing items for service at employees. And while everyone would talk about the situation, including the assistant management, no one would ever do anything about it. fast forward, and I was living in Idaho on a military base. And all good seasoned military wives know there's a pecking order, and I was really new. See, wives, as well as military members, are subject to a caste and class status. Wives are to bake, make babies, support our military, be seen, not heard, and we are definitely not allowed to challenge or change the status quo for fear it will impact our members' career and their livelihood. Quickly, you're labeled. But for some of us, military or not, the label, it becomes a banner to bring into battle. And after dealing with psychotic, crazy stalker pilot neighbor in Virginia, and operating within the parameters of military regs as to how it was to keep myself and my family safe, because assuredly no one else was going to, I found that my fear, yet again, was the catalyst to drive me forward toward action. Now, in my experience, I find in which is people who accept things as they are dislike powerful people. In fact, it can enrage them. It essentially makes you a target, sometimes a scapegoat, and for those that can't muster up courage or possibility, that's exactly what they do. Now, you can accept someone's opinion as fact and be frozen in your circumstance, or you can hone your focus on the fact. All these battles have had some very intense impact upon my health, but I'm not done yet. There's so much more to overcome. And thinking about my own circumstances, I ponder, what is it that keeps people inside the box they accept themselves to be in? And I hypothesize that it's comfort and insecurity that keeps people beholden to their circumstance. Why is it that some people, once they accept what is, find a way to overcome when others just accept? See, your significance is not predicated on status. It's what you are and what you have on the inside, what you have to give, what you have to bring to the fight. Don't give in to that narrative that you can't change your circumstance or that you can't even empower another when you have no power yourself. Your story is so significant. Your acts are significant. We all struggle at times with the truth that each one of us is significant, but when you act to change and challenge the box you've put yourself in or placed yourself in, wonderful things are set in motion. And those wonderful things may be difficult to overcome, but it provides you an opportunity for the next battle. Speed bumps are tossed your way, but with incremental steps, you slowly gain ground. And that is when you start to build inner resilience. That's the difference between facts and opinion. The fact is you overcame. And if you didn't the first time, it provides data so that you can do it better the next time. So how many of you practice self-talk? Are you one of those who needs constant stimuli that keeps you in a place of inaction, numbed out, which is an excuse to accept your current state? I could have believed that the FAA was indeed Goliath, and I could have stepped aside and allowed neighborhood leaders to handle the situation. But knowing who I am, I just couldn't lay it down nor leave it to chance. And I was on a mission because the outcome was so imperative. See, when I was diagnosed with an aneurysm and I looked at that potential bomb in my head and accepted the fact of what was, my goal was not necessarily to survive. It was to provide and make provision for my family if things went south. That's what my property embodied for me. It embodied future. How many times do people try to sell you their opinion as a fact? And why are some people so willing to accept opinion, someone's version of fact? Fuck the FAA. Taking my hard-fought purchase of my property and tanking my home value? No way. And I didn't fight through brain surgery, and I didn't fight through breast cancer, and I didn't fight for my rights to exist on this goddamn planet to have the government steal everything I had overcome to bring me to that moment. Not today. Not tomorrow. I didn't go to school for political science. I didn't even know how to garner the attention this issue intended and needed to require. What I did know was that fear operates by holding people captive. Fear keeps people stuck. Fear tells us it's not possible. It's never been done before. So once again, I broke out my standard, my banner, and while wrapped up like a mummy from surgery in 102 heat, I made flyers, and I distributed them to every single neighborhood affected. And I did that also with some help. I posted it on our online neighborhood network. Now, my grandma used to make quite a ruckus at stores when back in the early 80s, stores, and some of you may remember, stores would use promos in order to get people to come into the store and shop at their store. And rarely were the promotional items ever available for the people that actually showed up. But Rusty, my grandma, she never left the store without a promo. And in most times, that was the only thing she left with in hand. It was a good lesson for an 8-year-old to learn. Focus on what's the fact. Shine a light. Humble yourself. Put down your pride. This will certainly move you ahead towards your goal. Over 507 people showed up to city council at the first meeting regarding the flight path changes. People became engaged. They didn't have to fear fighting it alone, and they didn't have to accept the narrative that the government can do what it wants. No. And when so-called leaders inserted themselves into my efforts, they tried all sorts of things to get me to go away, just like many store managers did to my grandma. I didn't require permission to march into the mayor's office, nor into Senator McCain's office. I didn't need permission to speak candidly with Senator Flake or Representative Pastor. In fact, Ruben Gallego, who came to one of my first meetings, came before he took office. People all over the country called me. They messaged me and wanted to know how it was that Phoenix was the first to demand action by the FAA, and I simply stated, throw a temper tantrum so big that they will have to hear you. And despite naysayers' best efforts, I had people I never knew coming and offering me help along the way. And for each person whose job it was to take me down or shut me up, I had two more that came to my aid, who helped guide me, who supported me, to refocus me. News anchors were at my door through each phase of the discussions, and after every city council meeting being held on the subject, Ron was in one breath amazed and in another annoyed. And when the neighborhood leaders refused to entertain solutions, as they didn't want to make trouble for the city and expose the truth, I sent a team member to the FAA airline symposiums and found out and recorded from the FAA direct that our city employees, particularly the airport people, knew about the change and even helped to develop the new flight path. And while leaders tried to quiet me, I broke the story. In fact, the mayor's office was so worried of what I would say, I had a standing appointment to which, if I had someone or something in my way, I could simply walk into the office and have any ear needed to provide a solution. Ben Tracy from CBS National Morning News came to interview me at my home. The mayor came to my home with his own bodyguards. But the dirty side of things, people were tasked to silence me on a local level, on a federal level, and within the community to make me seem crazy. But I was on a mission. No way was anyone going to take my family's future. And when neighborhood leaders refused the truth that the FAA was placating and trying to run out the legal time clock, I used all the tools I had available, networks forged, to bring it to legal action. And because the community leaders pushed back so hard, I had to find another way to bring it to others. Old Mayor Terry Goddard, I got that in front of him. And then we got that information in front of Mayor Stanton. And then we all had a powwow. And then I asked Terry Goddard to explain to the neighborhood leaders that we could work with the city's legal team in tandem, which was a win for all. And in that process, we kicked FAA butt. And it worked out for others, too, despite efforts to shut me up. I mean, it gave Ruben Gallego his first piece of legislation. And it gave a platform and a ticket for Stanton to run for Arizona government. Sure, just like anything, people try to steal from you, as there's plenty of credit stealers and plagiarizers, and no matter who's trying to claim fame, the fact still remains. And from that fight, I wasn't left unscathed. I had battle scars to prove it. The stress of that, coupled with my first round of breast cancer, left me empty and damaged, and I was afraid. I had succumbed to fear, and I let it paralyze me. Was I going to let it paralyze me like it did my mom, who lived through 18 years of physical abuse before empowering herself to leave my father? I became hopeless, and after being mobbed, I felt I had no more fight left in me, and I began to accept everyone else's opinion of me as a truth. And when I was ostracized, and when I was defamed, and when I really struggled, I didn't know who I was. I was isolated and I was alone. Ron was gone because he was deployed. My family members were going through their own shit at the time, and I became reclusive to cope. And I dressed like a homeless person, and I went out at night and I hid from the world. And I believed the false narrative because it was the sound of their voices that was so deafening. And in my emptiness and in my self-loathing, I realized I only had one thing to offer this world. Now, I spent a lot of time with homeless people in that phase of my life, and I realized the only thing I had left to offer was a sympathetic ear and maybe a little bit of hope. And a couple of times during this time, I'd get asked for money. And on one particular instance where I gave a guy some change, he got upset that I didn't give him a $5 bill. And that made me pretty mad. So I thought to myself, what can I do in this instance? As I was emotionally empty, people were continuously asking things of me in every turn. Family, friends, homeless, on and on. So I decided to make some paper hearts, and every time someone asked me for something, whether it was for help or for money or asked me to do something on their behalf, I chose to give them a paper heart. And on that paper heart, there were words of encouragement. Sure, I had homeless and sometimes entitled persons throw them back in my face, but since that's all I had to offer, that's all I had to give. One day, I pulled up to the on-ramp of the freeway at I-10 and 7th Avenue, and there was a man with a sign asking for food and water for whatever it was he wanted. And as I rolled down my window and handed him that heart, the man opened it and read it, and he began to cry. Now, that particular heart said, "You're important." That is all I had to offer was my kindness. I was trying really hard to connect with humanity in the only way that I could, while still trying to heal within the surroundings of my city. And as luck would have it, I came across a Facebook post about a storytelling event. And I went to that storytelling event per Facebook notification, but alas, Facebook told me wrong, as it was the day prior, and I had missed it, and I really needed it. So I planned to attend the following week, and I did. And I sat in the back and I listened. I found solace. I heard stories of victory. I heard stories of quality of life. I heard stories of perseverance over rejection. And in that, I began to question my acceptance of the opinions of others that they had put on me. There are those that have the might and courage, and there are those that steal. Those who look fear in the face, and those who attempt to steal another's story. Which are you? Are you strong enough to find your truth, or do you accept another's opinion as fact? It was in that environment, in a caring, compassionate, safe place to share my soul, I unveiled who I was again. That place unburdened me from the bullshit narrative I came to accept. Just know this: we all have a purpose. See, someone had a purpose, and that purpose couldn't be fulfilled any other way. And if I remember it right, correct me if I'm wrong, but that young woman was struggling to find her truth. She was insecure, but she had a need to tell the truth, and she saw the same need in others. And by empowering others, she empowered herself. Certainly, there was fear. There was a fear that people wouldn't show up, that people would totally judge, that people would reject. But nonetheless, the fear of what could happen wasn't as great as the need. She wasn't going to let anything stop her and keep her from her truth. So let's that be the takeaway from this storytelling event, that no matter what, you, all of you, are important. No matter what has happened to you, no matter what bullshit is thrown at you, no matter who steals from you, you are significant and you can overcome anything you put your focus to. You can find your way back too. Thank you, Jess, for empowering others to speak their truth. It's truly been a very healing, growing experience and endeavor for countless individuals, and I am so very blessed to have been a part of it. Thank you.
Keep it going for Nicole. Good evening, Chatterbox. I am your co-host, Estevan Pina.
Hello.
We're going to go ahead and we're a little cramped on time, so we're just going to go ahead and introduce the next storyteller. Please help me welcome somebody who, like her namesake, helps brighten up the stage every time she comes up here with her genuinely amazing smile and her sincere nature. Please help me welcome Joy.
Thank you, Esteban. That was really sweet. I appreciate that. And just a full disclosure, like I have on an emotional scale of 1 to 10, this sweet spot of like 4 to 6 where I don't cry. So this is a big night, so there might be some tears. I'm just giving you a pre-warning on that one. But when I was little, when I was young, I had a voice. It was strong. I had opinions, and it didn't matter who I was talking to, I would tell them exactly how I felt. The first story that I remember that my mom loves to share is when she says I was 2.5. I mean, it was a big event, so I remember some things about it, but for me to be 2.5, remember it, it's pretty big. But we were in California visiting my aunt and my cousin, who is about the same age as my sister. They're about 4 years older than me. So they were six, and I was 2.5. And we were all sitting at dinner. My cousin's dad, who was this oil rigger, mean kind of guy who was, you know, just kind of tough from Texas, made us all steaks for dinner. And the adults were sitting at the big adult table. My aunt was there, my mom, my cousin's grandma was there. And her dad, Red, that was his nickname because he had red hair. I'm surrounded by redheads in my family. But Red had made steaks for everyone, and he had already eaten his dinner and was sitting in a recliner. And so the adults were at the big table, and us three girls, my sister, my cousin, and I were sitting at the little kid table in the apartment close to the living room. And my cousin didn't want to eat her steak. It was well done. It was tough. It was a big steak. She was little. And so she was complaining that she didn't want to eat her steak. And so Red said, well, no, Katie, you need to eat your steak. If Katie doesn't eat her steak, everyone, then everyone else gets dessert, but Katie doesn't get any. And so my cousin's grandma said, Katie, honey, come over here and bring your steak. I'll cut it up for you. And so she did, and she started, you know, trying to eat some steak. And Red said, nope, Katie doesn't get any steak. And something in me, the injustice, the frustration in my 2.5-year-old body just shot up out of the table. My little plastic chair flipped to the back, and I walked right over to him in his recliner, and I said, shut up, Red, and I mean it. And don't smoke cigarettes, Red, and I mean it. The entire room went silent, and my mom, with just a horror and disgrace, swooped me up and took me to my cousin's room, and she was about to spank me, and then she stopped, and she was like, hell no. She had the courage to tell this man what everyone else wanted to say but didn't have the balls to do it. So we sat in there, and I didn't see him again until my cousin graduated from junior high 11 years later. But another story that is often told about me was one of my older brother's friends down the street, who was 13 years older than me, 6 foot tall boy, would pick on me all the time and just tease me, little kid. And I would often call him and just get so frustrated. And I would say, Bobby, you're a boff bag and a fault face, and I hate you. And the other one that I can remember is when I was hanging out with my nephew. I'm a baby of seven, so there's a large spread. So I have a nephew that's actually older than me by a few months. But he and I were best friends. And there was one summer that I can remember where we hung out all the time. And we were really into playing the Bushwhackers from one of those professional wrestling teams where you, like, stomp around and, like, wave your hands. And so I wanted to be, like, a team. I wanted to look just like him. That's what the tag team wrestlers do. So I thought, at the time, I had this gorgeous, curly, long hair, like, down to my butt. And I thought, I want to get my hair cut like a boy like Alex. So I went into my mom, and I had my hair in a side ponytail. And she was in the kitchen. And I don't know if I played this out just right, but I went in there, and I said, Mom, I want to cut my hair. And she said, no, Joy, your hair is so beautiful. And I strategically was by the drawer where she kept the scissors. And so I pulled them, yanked them out, and I grabbed my side ponytail, and I said, if you don't take me, I'm going to do it myself. She said, get in the car. So I had a voice when I was little, but somewhere along the line, right after I got my hair cut short like a boy, just like Alex's, something happened in my environment. Something happened in my experience. And I lost my voice. I think a lot of the messaging that I got was, you know, don't make dad angry or you're going to get the belt. In school, I learned you need to have friends or you don't exist. You're not going to matter. And so I lost that strong voice. And I didn't regain it until December 3rd, 2017, when I was about 35 or 36 years old. When I did a lot of therapy and worked through and realized that I had these crazy irrational belief systems that said, don't speak up, don't fight for yourself. You know, if you're not successful, you have to die. And it was so empowering when I had that moment when I finally realized, holy shit, it's okay to be myself and it's okay to try things and make mistakes. It's okay to be me. I can do this. And that gave me so much empowerment to, like, question those irrational beliefs and replace them with more healthy, rational ideas. It gave me the courage to quit a job that I kept for 13 years. And it gave me the courage to go and try to do stand-up comedy. And that tanked. But it's a lot harder than it looks, you know. Everyone that tells you should do it, tell them to fuck off because it's really hard. But I was telling my roommate kind of how, you know, I went to this comedy class and the owner was telling me, you know, I really wanted to have, like, be myself and not fully self-deprecate and, like, fall into that, you know, kind of comedic style. And his reaction or response to my punchlines was, no, you got to act like the sexy blonde that, like, brings home the guy and gets your daddy angry. And I was like, fuck you. So I was telling her that, and she's like, that might not be your style, but, you know, I have this friend that does storytelling. We should go and check it out. So I was like, okay, I mean, maybe I can use that to practice, maybe try to make my stories funny and stuff, so I'll go. And so we showed up at Fairtrade in September, and there was, okay, I'm getting to a seven, guys, so the tears might be coming, okay. But we showed up, and there was this woman with a short black haircut, Betty Page bangs, and these library glasses. And she was fucking amazing. She was smart, witty, so confident. She made me laugh. I was so impressed how I'm just going to refer to you because we all know who we're talking about now. But I was so impressed how you could quickly, you listen to everyone's stories and you could quickly relate to it with your segues to the next person, and how just funny you were and how meaningful these stories were and how you could stay with everyone when they were being up here vulnerable, and you did not shy away. You supported them through every story that they told. And like Esteban, man, the same. Like, I'm just so impressed by you guys and what you did. And I got the courage the next time I came. I'm like, okay, man, I'm going to tell a story. Funny. Most of my stories weren't funny. They were really serious. I talked a lot about therapy, so it was quite interesting how not funny I am. But I kept coming, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for creating this. I'm so thankful that even though I've only been able to do it for a short time, that you've given me a space to exercise my voice and empower me to try to I've just found it, and I'm just talking or bringing it back up again and telling my story, and you guys gave me this awesome space, this awesome community to be a part of, and I am so excited to see what you've got coming up next in your projects, and I just wanted to say thank you for giving us an empowering space to share our stories. Thank you.
It's good, guys. I got waterproof mascara. It's going to be like this all night, isn't it? Anyway, on that note, I mean, yeah, the show is ending. Over by where Jeff is, there are a pack of yellow papers. Or there's a stack of yellow papers over there? Yes. On these yellow papers are all of the other storytelling shows in Maricopa County. So if you are still looking for storytelling events after... So Chatterbox ends. You can check out one of these many shows. There's 8, I believe, listed on there. Something for everyone. Check them all out. They're all amazing, ran by amazing people. Storytelling doesn't have to end here, and I really hope it doesn't for all of you, because it's a wonderful community to be a part of. All right, our next storyteller has been a regular since this show wasn't called Chatterbox. It was way before that, when it was called Yarn Ball. Put your hands together for Yuval.
Good evening, guys. My name is Yuval, and yeah, Yarn Ball. That seems like so long ago, but the story of empowerment. I guess when I started thinking about the theme, I started thinking power, but my brain works a little bit different, so I went weakness-wise. So the feel power, you kind of have to feel that weakness before that part. So a lot of my life, I've always kind of, try to balance things out. So one word would mean another to me, and kind of found the balance between those two. So for me, empowerment, I guess, just a string of stories throughout my life kind of felt, and they kind of all collected and then made an impact on my life, I guess. I guess it's go back. My mother was a teenager. She was 14 when she had me, so I didn't have the greatest starter kit to my life. So I kind of bounced around a lot, went through a lot of sorrow, pain, and kind of found my way into a church school. And I grew up Catholic, Lutheran, kind of bounced around, like I said. And they give you these studies for religion, and I kind of just felt, I guess, numb at that point, just having gone through a lot of things with my mother, the abandonment and all this, that I became a people pleaser. So I just kind of did what I was told to do. Wasn't really the healthiest thing for me to do, but I just kind of did it. And throughout the whole schooling, I just kind of felt myself like a video game, I guess. I guess the game I'm thinking about is Pac-Man. You kind of get these guidelines. This is how I kind of thought religion was. You kind of get these guidelines, these walls, and you can go right, left, whatever. It's just a notion of control that you're supposed to have, this free will. But you're still in a box, and you still have walls. And you get older. You get another level of it. Colors change, different type of obstacles, but it's the same thing over and over. So this had this, being a little kid, have this notion of being my life being that way. I guess the first empowerment that I had was questioning things. And the way I got there was hearing something on cartoon. And the cartoon that I was watching was Bugs Bunny. And that gives you away my age. I'm almost 40. And I just had a birthday yesterday. Happy birthday to me. And so Bugs Bunny, he's up to his old shenanigans. And he says to Elmer Fudd, life's short. Have some fun. And he's smoking a cigar. And he says, but don't screw it up. And those things just stuck, you know, just stuck. And then I started questioning my outlook on religion, I guess. I started questioning a lot of things, people told me. So that empowerment, I guess, went back to some of the church is teaching about when God closes a door, a window opens. But I think that's burglary, you know, crawling through a window. So like, why do that? You know, why do that? And so from there on, I started thinking, like, what else can you do? How else can you get into these things? So I started searching for keys, just like a video game too, as well, I guess. And one of the five keys that I found was the Bugs Bunny one. Chuck Palahniuk is one of my favorite authors. He had said to me through his books, moment to moment in your life are nothing but stories, and that stuck up with me. And I always collected my stories. I always thought back on it. Oh, I could tell this, and share with somebody, and always be this way. And then the next person would probably be Tony Robbins. He gave me another key. He had said to me, all the sorrow, the pain, and all these things that you go through your life makes you a stronger person because you survived. You got through it. You're here today. Share with somebody. And that is real, real power, is you actually sharing somebody and making them better. And then the last person was my mother. My mother, I think it took a long time for me to kind of realize this, but she did play outside the box. She had a baby, but she took her own path. Wasn't the right ones, but made her own path, and we found each other at the end, made peace with everything. But, you know, peace is not what we all strive for. Peace is momentary. So I think having change and all that stuff that comes with empowerment, you kind of have to shake the boat a little bit. You kind of have to think outside the box. You kind of have to ask questions and be yourself, you know. So I did all these things. I collected all these things. And today, like being 38 years old, I can kind of look back and I'm empowered by myself, by my mother, by Chuck Palahniuk, all these people, all these collective of stories. And I share my stuff. One of my workers had just had a baby a couple months ago, and I met him 4 years ago. He's pretty bad. He drank a lot. He did drugs a lot. And he got fired. And he called me like months later and told me, like, what should I do? I'm losing another job because of my temper. I was like, bro, you got to go to anger management. And, you know, just start one at a time. Just count to three, count to three. And all these stories that I had gone through, I told him about. This is what helped me. This is how I got through things. And he did what I said. And he called me, like I said, a few months ago. He's like, I did what you said. I did anger management, and I'm having a baby, and I'm so happy. And that felt good. And I felt power, you know, like going through me to other people. And I think, so Jesse, that's my time, guys. Jesse, I just want to thank you for allowing me to have a platform to share my power and my stories. And hopefully you guys will share it as well. Thank you.
Keep it going for Yuval. Our next storyteller is such a wonderful addition to our regular storytellers that we have at this show. She always brings such an incredible sense of honesty and transparency when she tells. Please help me welcome Bobby.
Good evening. Like Esteban said, my name is Bobby. And when I started thinking about the theme empowerment. I think immediately it went to self-empowerment for me. And then, disclosure too, like the previous person, it's been an emotional day, so just a warning. But it went to self-empowerment. And then I think the phrase or the few words, acts of self-bravery, came to mind too. And one of the first times I think I can really remember having a moment of really having that self-empowerment was when I was 15. I went to summer school in Boulder, Colorado, and my mom didn't know anything about it, like that I was applying for it or the application process and nothing. Just I told her that I got accepted to this program and I was interested in going, and she let me go. And I didn't know anybody where I was going. I didn't have any friends that were going to the program. I didn't know any of like the staff. I didn't know the play. I didn't know nothing. And I wanted to go, and I went. And the first day that I was there, that I flew in, got my dorm assignment and my roommate assignment and everything, and I was sitting in the room on the bed, and I was thinking, like, what am I doing here? Like, I don't know anybody. I just felt so uncomfortable. I felt out of place. I felt like, you know, I'm just like, how am I going to do this for 6 weeks? Like, I couldn't imagine it. And I knew if I called my mom, because she's such a good mom, I knew if I called her and told her, I'm like, Mom, I don't feel right here. I don't want to be here. I knew she would like get in her ride and start driving, you know, the 9 hours to come get me, because, you know, she would do that. But I was like, you know, started talking to myself, and I knew, you know, I don't want to do that. I wanted to be there. Obviously, I had gone through the whole process of getting there. So I just told myself, you know, you're here, you know, you're going to stay here, and you're going to get up, you're going to go outside this room, and you're going to start talking to the first person that you see. That was my plan. And I did it. I got up, I went outside the room, and I started talking to the first person that I saw, which was my friend Mia, who I still know, you know, 20 years later, and still consider her a really good friend. And she thought I was her roommate later on. Like, she didn't know why this random person just started talking to her. And I told her, you know, later on. But that was like one of the first moments that I can remember just kind of really talking myself through something, I think. And, you know, later on through my life, you know, I can remember similar moments. A couple of years later, I graduated from high school and I was 17. And I started college at U of A in Tucson, and I had never visited. I didn't go on college visits like a lot of students do nowadays. I went to U of A. The first time that I went there, moved into the dorm, was the first time that I saw the campus, been to Tucson, never had been to Tucson before either. And, you know, had those similar, like, what am I doing? You know, what am I going to do here? But just really talking myself through it, because, again, like, I always knew I would go to college. This is something that I always knew, like, I wanted to do. Another time, rewinding back real quick, when I was a junior in high school, I went to D.C. On my own for another program, and went without a chaperone as a 16-year-old to D.C. from this tiny little town on the reservation, and flew to D.C. to Reagan Airport and had to find, like, my program, my sponsors, and everything. And looking back, I'm like, what was I doing? Like, I always think if I had a kid, I'm like, I would not have let her go, you know, to D.C. on her own. And my mom was always hesitant about letting me go to do stuff, but, you know, I'm thankful that she let me do those things. And then just throughout, my 20s and my 30s, I just think I've always been a person, when I think back to it, I've always been a person that has enjoyed events. I've always enjoyed going to things. I've always enjoyed connecting with people. And I remember in my hometown growing up, we had a trading post, and in the trading post, there was a big, bulletin board. They don't have a lot of those anymore. Like, a lot of people don't have bulletin boards with flyers on there, but we had a huge bulletin board with all these events, and I always remember looking at it. And then going into my 30s and going into the city, I still like to go to events, but my options just got wider because there's so many events going on in the city, like great events like this. And my poor boyfriend, you know, he's always working, but on his days off, I would be like, oh, we can go do this in the morning, and then we can go do this in the evening, and I would just, like, fill up his days until I had to, like, scale back and be like, okay, let him, you know, enjoy his day off. And then my poor siblings would be getting texts from me, excuse me, and I would be like, hey, this is going on. Do you want to check it out with me? And poor guys are probably just, like, getting texts from me all the time, and then I kind of, like, had to take a step back, and then I would still text them stuff, but then I would say, I would have a little like disclaimer, I guess. I would be like, no pressure if you want to go. Like, I don't want to pressure you. And then eventually, I think, you know, in my 30s, I started kind of like thinking, well, if I can't find somebody to go to these events with, like, why should I not go on my own to these events? And so I started eventually, like, if I couldn't, you know, if I didn't have anybody to go with to something, I would go by myself. Was awkward at first sometimes because you just feel like self-conscious, like, you know, are people watching me? Like, why is that person here by herself? Like, she looks sketchy, like, what's she up to? But after a while, you know, I get used to it, and I think I really agree that you should be your own best company, you know, because you spend the most time with yourself, you know, every day. And if you can't enjoy your own company, like, how do you expect other people to enjoy your company? So, you know, I'm not a big shopper, but I enjoy, like, browsing at Goodwill or consignment stores, things like that, and just hanging out on my own. And I think just being comfortable with myself to do those things. And I think this theme was a really good theme for me, just to be able to, like, reflect back on things, because I'm, like, in a real season of change and transition right now to just to be able to look back on, like, brave 15-year-old Bobby, brave 15 or 17-year-old Bobby, you know, brave Bobby in her 20s. And just to know that, as scary as things are right now, you know, that I'm brave and that I'll get through this too, because I've done it before and I've got through things. So thank you, and thank you again to Jesse for everything.
Guys, keep it going for Bobby. Whew. All right, guys, it's like rapid fire storytelling. No, me in the middle, okay? Put your hands together for Andrea.
Can I lower this? Is that okay? That's okay, I'm fine. Okay, so when I was 9 years old, my 22-year-old sister told my family, my parents, that she was going to have a baby. She was pregnant with my oldest nephew. Now, at 9 years old, kids are intuitive, guys. I knew that there was some, like, level of disapproval and maybe even disappointment. But at the end of the day, my parents, they're really loving, supportive people. And so they supported her through her being pregnant and kind of having a rough time with her now ex-fiance. But anyway, their disappointment and disapproval was not a concern of mine. I didn't really care that they were giving off weird energy. For me, I did the math, did some calculations, and I realized I was going to be an auntie. And I was so thrilled. Now, I had a little brother, so I'm like the middle-ish child. So I had a little brother and two older sisters. And I gotta say, being an older sister was so overrated. I really begged for, like, a little brother. And then I got here, all little kids do, right? They're like, oh, I want a little brother or sister. And then they get one and they're like, oh, it sucks. But I was so stoked to be an aunt. And so, you know, fast forward X amount of months, whatever. And I'm 10 years old, and my nephew, this cute little baby with the little faux hawk, just a natural one, it's crazy. He's, like, brought into this world, and he's so precious, and his name is Reese. And as a kid, my sister was mostly a single mom, and so she worked a lot. And I got the privilege, honestly, I consider it that, of babysitting my nephew all the time. Probably way too much, honestly. And so, in a way, I kind of feel like I almost got to raise him slash be almost like a sister, because we're closer in age than my sister and I are. We're only 10 years apart, and my sister and I are like 13 years apart. And so I got what I like to call the full human experience. You know, like, I got to watch this this little baby turn into this great person. Reese, he's now 14 years old. And, you know, as teenagers, they're all like angsty, and he wears like, you know, like Mac DeMarco shirts and stuff. And he's like totally into like hipster things, because I raised him. And and it just makes me like super proud. And of course, I feel what a lot of parents feel about their children as they age. I look back and I really miss the memories I have of him being a little kid. I really cherish those. I have so many memories of us in my backyard playing baseball and, like, you know, play wrestling and letting him have an unplugged controller so he could think he was playing video games with me. And, you know, just a lot of things. I remember, like, helping my parents feed him baby food and a lot of really precious, adorable things. But at the same time, I am very, very grateful, and in fact, I feel very empowered to see him changing into, like, I feel weird, but like a man. Like, he's becoming a man, right? Like, he's 14, and he's kind of in that, like, in that phase in life where he thinks he's like becoming an adult, right? He's already stressed out about college and what he wants to do with his life, and I just think it's so funny, but so great that he's already so into it, and he always comes to me for advice, and he calls me and texts me, and whenever I go up to see him and my sister, you know, he always tries to like pull me aside or ride with me in my car instead of my sister's car or whatever. And that those things are so meaningful. And a couple of months ago, I got to see him and he was opening up to me about, you know, like his angst. And also he told me he's been feeling kind of depressed. He's had a lot of changes in his life. And I'm sure you all remember as a kid, a lot of those changes you have no say in. You know, you just have to kind of accept whatever your parent chooses to do. You kind of got to go along with it. And so he moved, and now he has like a stepdad and all these other things. And he had to change schools. And so he's had a really hard time like making friends. And he was opening up to me about his depression. And so and one thing that I realized is that teenagers love when you're honest back. So I was able to open up to him, and I told him a little bit about what I dealt with as a teenager, and even now, you know, with depression and anxiety. And I opened up to him about me seeing a therapist recently. And he actually asked me to ask his mom if I could talk to his mom about setting up like a therapy appointment for him. And so I did. And he was just really grateful. And he texted me this a few weeks ago. Okay, I'm not a crier, but I honestly might cry when I read this, because this was like really cool. But this 14-year-old angsty kid texted me and he said, "Hey, thanks for listening today. It really meant something to me. You're the only adult I feel like I can talk to about my feelings, and your advice really helps me." How cute and insightful is that? So I hope that if you ever get a chance to work with the youths, that you do, because they're really cool and they make you feel so good about yourself, and you're helping the world, someone's small little world, in your own unique way. So thank you very much.
Keep it going. Our next storyteller isn't just an incredible DJ. He's also an amazing storyteller. Please help me welcome Jeff.
Good evening. So, I'm sitting in a wheelchair in the parking lot of the hospital. My dad, who is 82 years old, it's actually his birthday today, he's 88, holy crap. People get old, I guess. It's okay. My dad, who's 82, is wheeling me in a wheelchair, doing that shuffly old person walk, wheeling me towards the doors of the emergency room. It's Super Bowl Sunday, and This doesn't have anything to do with the Super Bowl because I've never watched one in its entirety. Shout out if you like football. It's cool. The reason why I'm in a wheelchair is because my legs stopped working. It was like someone had Frankensteined a dead person's legs onto my body, and they did a really shitty job like reattaching the nerves. Like they did not work at all. Like I couldn't even stand up. So I'm wheeled into the emergency room, and when something's really wrong with you at the emergency room, you get to go to the VIP section. You know, if you have the flu, you know, you go wait with the common people. Like, if you can't walk, VIP. So, VIP for me. Anyone who's been in the emergency room, it takes forever, even on Super Bowl Sunday. Lots of people with, I guess, a lot of people drink during the Super Bowl, and there were a lot of, like, cuts and, like, banged heads, and I don't know, maybe their team wasn't doing well. I don't know. Lots of messed up people in there, and I was one of them. So they get to me, and I told them everything that was going on with me. It's like, hey, like, this thing has been going on. It's been progressing for 3 weeks. Like, I can't walk anymore. What had happened, like, I didn't have any reflexes in my legs. Like, when they do the little mallet test, it was like, it was like striking a piece of New York strip, just like no response. A couple of the, I don't know if they were nurse practitioners or orderlies, I don't know, hospital workers with uniforms who aren't doctors. A couple guys come in, they're like, okay, Jeff, or okay, Mr. Cardello, we want you to try standing. And I'm like, that is a really bad idea. They're like, no, it's okay. We're going to stand around you. And if you know, if you have any trouble, we're here. I hadn't planned that day on doing any sort of like trust fall exercises. So I push myself up from the wheelchair and like I automatically topple over. Like there was no mistaking how screwed up my body was. It was like a knockout punch, and I collapsed into, you know, the arms of the orderly, like he was like a prize fighter. So I get admitted to the hospital. I already knew what I had. Like I had Googled the symptoms. I'm like, hey, I have Guillain-Barré syndrome, which only 1 out of 500,000 people get. So, and also I have zero medical training. So no one believed me when I told them. They're like, let's do some tests. So they did a CAT scan. They did an MRI. They did a spinal tap, all which sucked. But I did end up having Guillain-Barré. I'm like, hey, you didn't have to do all those fancy tests because I know how to Google. But, like, I couldn't walk anymore. Like, I started to get better. They, I had this, what happens in Guillain-Barré is it's an autoimmune syndrome where your body attacks itself. So the insulation on my nerves had been like completely shredded. So that electrical signal was just like staticky. But I started doing physical therapy. And physical therapy begins with a physical therapist like putting a belt around you. Like, I don't know, you feel like a horse harnessed up to something. But they have a belt around you. And like my first steps with the walker, I had this thing called drop foot, which is exactly what it sounds like. No heel to toe action, just Frankenstein feet all over the place. But I slowly started to get better. Like I actually snuck out on my own down the hallway with the walker. Didn't let the physical therapist know that. But I felt myself getting stronger. And, you know, I was able to walk down that hallway. I got out of the hospital. I still have the walker. I didn't want anyone to see me with the walker, so I didn't go out in public, but I just cruised the streets around my parents' house. First, I was like, hey, if I can get to the end of my parents' driveway, I've accomplished something. If I can get down the end of the street, I've accomplished something. So finally, like, I was able to ditch the walker. I started using a cane, and I just started setting further and further goals. And when something like this happens to you, progress isn't measured in days or weeks, it's months. Like 6 months passes, no more cane. A year passes, I go on my first 8-mile bike ride. I'm 6 years out. This biking season, I went on a 60-mile bike ride, which, holy crap, the last hour wasn't that pretty, but I accomplished it. So with the theme of empowerment, like when something you take for granted is stripped away from you, like walking, you get a new appreciation for that. And sometimes in life, we don't realize we're making progress. We may be taking one step after another, feeling like we're going nowhere, but when we look back, we've actually come really far. So I feel like this night, Chatterbox, I've come a long way as a storyteller and a person, and this has been an awesome night. Thank you.
Guys, keep it going for Jeff. All right. Our next storyteller is a longtime regular here. Put your hands together for Allison D.
Started talking yet. I can't cry. Can't cry until the mouth opens. Come on, we gotta make a scene, right? So I agree with. Hi, everybody. Jeff just said something that everybody's been saying wonderful things that are lovely to hear, but Jeff just said something so wonderful, talking about that empowerment taking root in the soil of vulnerability when you start small, when you feel small. And I would like you guys to, I want to invite you to try something right now. I want you to picture in your mind somebody that you really care about, somebody who's always made you feel loved, supported. If you don't have such a person in your life, imagine even a fictional character that you think embodies that, a concept, an idea. I want you to frame that in your mind, the embodiment, that feeling of safety and nurturing, care, concern, unconditional support. I want you to feel that in your heart, in your mind. There's so much feedback ruining my romantic moment here. I want you to feel it in your whole body. Feel it in your heart. Feel it in your mind. And I want you to imagine that person standing behind you, hands on your shoulders, pushing down those hiked up, stressed out shoulders, just giving them a gentle squeeze and asking you to just breathe. Go ahead and do that. Take a deep breath, slow and long. Fill your chest and let it out slowly and relax. I've brought a couple of items with me to kind of keep me on track today because I do think that certain stories of empowerment do begin in a place of vulnerability. And if you allow me to take a little journey through time here, I want to go back 18 years ago. In 2001, I became a mother. I have my tarot cards here. The Fool, the beginning. That new excitement, that energy, the beginning of a journey when it seems like nothing can harm you. And even when there are challenges along the way, you can't even see them. You're blind to them. It's like wearing a red flag is a blindfold and a cape. You just want to jump in. And becoming a parent can be very much like that. When you're in love and you believe that you're ready, because you can totally be ready to be 100% responsible for another human being when you're barely capable of being responsible for yourself, right? That's a thing. Yeah, wait until you're ready to have children. We will all be childless forever if we wait until we're actually ready. But in 2001, I gave birth to a son called Shiva, named for Shiva Nataraja, the Hindu god of both compassion and destruction. Why would you name a baby after destruction? Well, listen. They drool on everything. They poop on everything. They destroy your sleep. And whatever you were as a child, you don't get to be that anymore, because Shiva Nataraja doesn't just destroy things. He clears the way for new beginnings. And there is nothing that will change your life like becoming a parent. Well, that's what I thought at the beginning of 2001, but did I mention I lived in New York City? There are some things that can really change your life more than doing the same thing that everyone around you is doing. The tower card, that thing that's too big to fail, that thing that's so huge and durable that it could never collapse, and yet there it is collapsing. So here I was on my fool's journey, my new beginning, young mother, new life, everything's exciting. And there goes the tower, knocking it all down. Two towers. I watched from my kitchen window. I watched the second plane hit, holding my infant son in my arms. I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember what it was like 18 years ago when that was happening. Maybe you saw it on the news. I'm pretty sure it rattled everybody, but I didn't know what to think. All I saw was a lot of smoke. Wondering, like, is there some kind of biochemical agent? We're far enough away that I couldn't even hear any sounds from it, but still wondering, are we dead? And what a lot of people maybe didn't know is that it wasn't like a one and done where it just fell that day. No, it took hours, and the smoke kept billowing for months and months and months at a time. And with a new baby, family kept pressuring us to leave. You gotta get the hell out of that stupid, dangerous, nasty city. Who the fuck would want to live in New York in the first place? I mean, it's the greatest city in the world, but what could it possibly offer? It's the greatest city in the world. I mean, except for Phoenix, right? I gave in to the pressure. New beginnings, right? Things that are too big to fail. So I went. And I moved away. Went 350 miles upstate to a little town that had nothing but snow. Got to live in a trailer. Struggled to find work. To work in a daycare that was so dirty and creepy and weird that I refused to bring my own son to work with me at the daycare. Got a job at... Oh, there goes all my cards. Speaking of things falling, that's okay. I got some right here. These are probably the magic ones that tell the rest of the story. I was throwing them all on the floor anyway. So I'm in the city where it's not really a city. It's mostly trees. There are horses right outside my trailer. They're not mine. They just stare at me in judgment. Horses are assholes, ladies and gentlemen. And slowly, everything started to fall away. This new beginning felt like purgatory. Kind of felt like hell. It was something that I had consented to, that I didn't think was a good idea, and I did it anyway. The devil card represents our demons, the things that we accept in our life, the choices that we make. We know they're bad ideas, and we go along with it because it gives us greater comfort than maybe making the better decision. And slowly I started to fall apart. My mother called me one day and said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "I think I'm dying. I think I'm dying slowly. I think that every part of my body is shutting down. I think I'm so miserable that I have willed my heart to stop beating, and I'm just waiting for my lungs and my brain to go next." And she said, "Maybe you should leave." And there was a big protest at the UN. I got on the bus, I went, and I marched, and it was freezing. And I was bundled up, I had layers of clothes, and I started seeing young ladies wearing miniskirts in the middle of January. at this protest, freezing, shivering, their legs turning purple. And I started dragging them one by one into public bathrooms and saying, I'm going to get in the other stall and I'm going to give you my clothes. And I started putting my clothes on these other women so that we could all protest together. And I looked around, and there were military police with machine guns all over New York City. I don't know if any of you know that. When you watch the news and you see places in other countries that have military police with machine guns in the streets, and you go, I could never live in a country like you do. You do. And I started going back to the city. I would get on the bus once a week, and I would spend 3 days couch surfing in New York. If I didn't have a couch to sleep on, I slept in the library. And I started going back, little by little. And one day, my friend's dad said, why don't you just stay? I felt like I was dying, but funny thing, got all these cards to give me cues. The death card doesn't signify actual physical death. It signifies transformation. So I started looking for a home. And on the day that I found one, I passed through Chinatown and got these wonderful cookies called Happy Mouth. I mainly bought them because they were called Happy Mouth. And, like, I'm going to be honest, they didn't taste that great, but they were called Happy Mouth. And when you're holding a box that says Happy Mouth, you can't help but be happy. And I found my house, and I had my Happy Mouth, and I'm skipping through the subways, and I see a big group of military police with their machine guns watching me skip, and I'm in a good mood, and they're smiling at me. And I walked up, I said, how you doing? And I said, pretty good, you look really happy. And I said, I have Happy Mouth, do you want a Happy Mouth? And they said, no, thank you. And I said, how can you not want Happy Mouth? Who doesn't want a Happy Mouth? And they said, we can't. I said, you are not allowed to have a Happy Mouth. And they said, well, we're not allowed to take food from people. You could be poisoning me. I said, do I look like I've been poisoned? They just kind of giggled, and they said, we're not allowed to take anything that could look like a bribe. And I stayed, and I chatted with them and flirted with them. I unabashedly flirted with them and suddenly realized that there are different kinds of discomfort, that the discomfort of being away from my home, that being surrounded by snow and horses and peace and stability, was greater than the discomfort of being surrounded by explosions and machine guns, and that sometimes you find your power in a place of discomfort. Thank you.
I made a mess.
Keep it going for Allison.
I started with a deck of 79.
Please help me welcome our next storyteller. We have Pete.
What's up, Fairtrade? How's everybody doing? Good. A lot of energy. I love it. I don't think I need to say anything but thank you, Jesse and Chatterbox. Thank you very much. Look at what you've done for all of us. You've given us a safe place to share, and you've tolerated me, which is more than I can say for most. So thank you. I want to start it out by saying that. This is a place I've been able to come and share lots of real experiences without having to censor myself, I don't think. Talk about drug use. Talk about all kinds of shit here. And I think it's awesome. And we need more things like this because in a time where everybody wants to be connected and together, we're so separated and apart. Things like this are great for the community. So I hope I see you again and our paths cross one day. All right. Enough with the mushy stuff, people. I'm going to tell you all about the first time, not the first time, but a time when my mom left me home by myself to watch my brothers. It was very empowering. Like I said, I've shared a little bit about my past. There's a lot of drug use in my family. I'm getting older and I'm thinking about procreating, thinking about making a child of my own. And it scares me. It terrifies me. You know, I don't want to be one of these parents arguing with their kids and their certified pre-owned Prius and shit. I don't want to be, you know, smacking them before they go to school and shit. Like, I don't want my kid to be Danny from Ninja Turtles. I don't want that. It terrifies me. It terrifies me because the only example or examples of parents that I have are my own parents. And those motherfuckers are crazy. My mom and dad got married after knowing each other for 2 weeks. My dad was only in this country for about a month. Cocaine will make you do some wild shit. I asked my dad. He said, you know, he got married because it was love. I had to take his word for it. But yeah, a lot of interesting things have transpired or happened to me in my life. But this is one that is a little more PG. I've shared some pretty crazy shit here, so I'll tone it down for this last time I share. My mom worked at a school that was about a 5-minute walk from our house. And it was summer school. It was a Monday morning. My mom had to go teach summer school. I don't know why I wasn't there. I didn't have to be there. Like, the only time I didn't have to be there was this summer. So my mom asked me to watch my little brothers. And I love my brothers. I love them very much. But there's one thing that I'm really good at, and it's pushing buttons. I know how to push people's buttons. I find buttons. There's big buttons, small buttons. There's hidden buttons. There's buttons on everybody. I'm really good at finding them. It's a gift. And I knew what to say and how to say it, when to say it to my brothers to get them to do what I wanted them to do. It would start out, you know, very innocent. We'd scare my youngest brother, pretend that I was possessed by a demon. Simple things, nothing elaborate, very innocent. This particular time, I convinced my two brothers to fight each other. And it starts out simple. It's like, oh, you gonna let him talk to you like that? And my, oh, he said this. And my brother's like, well, that's why you wear a retainer. And I was like, oh shit, you wear a retainer. It was just a lot of honesty. It wasn't really insults. Sometimes the truth hurts, guys. And so I got them riled up, and they were about to fight. And I said, oh, hold on, guys. If we're gonna do this, we gotta do it right. You guys gotta fight on mom's bed. All right. Get on mom's bed and fight. So my brother's like, all right. They get on the bed. They start kicking each other. This bullshit fighting. Not real. You know what I'm saying? So I had to break them up and like, come on, let's do this. Let's play for keeps. Come on. And they start going at it. And I'm just watching them, egging them on. And they're they're both on their backs and they're kicking each other, like fighting hardcore. And my baby brother pushes my younger brother Robert off the bed with his feet clean off, and I thought it was the greatest thing ever. I like fell out. I was like, oh shit, you got your ass whooped. And as he's falling, he falls on a frame that my mom hasn't hung yet and falls through the glass. It was like this giant frame, and he falls, breaks the glass, and I was like, oh shit, mom's gonna be pissed. And then we're cleaning it up, and then he turns around and he has probably like 37 cuts on his back. It was like just lines of blood on his back, and I almost fell out because I almost fainted because like it's blood and it's real, and we're home alone. And you know, when you're 12, the worst shit starts going through your head. Like CPS is gonna get called. We're gonna get taken away. What the fuck am I gonna do? So I do the smartest thing. I just put a dirty shirt on my brother's back and say, we're gonna go to mom and fix this. So my mom's in the middle of teaching her summer school class, and it's for all the kids. You know, they're struggling, they're sounding words out and shit, and it's like, you know, you walk in, they're like, he, and she's like, no, the word is the, and you know, struggle. And we walk in there, and it's dead silent, and like, I, you know, when you do something wrong and you walk in already explaining that you know you were wrong to your parents. You remember that when you were a kid? Like, mom, I don't know what happened. There's blood everywhere. There's broken glass. Bettine's bleeding. I don't know what to do. My mom's like, what? Robert's bleeding? She runs out. There's still chunks of glass in my brother's back. She's picking this glass out. And these, slowly but surely, all the students start to come out of the classroom and watch my mom reprimand all three of us and pick glass out of my brother's back. That wasn't the first or last time one of us made each other bleed, but it was very empowering to be there and be in charge of that moment and make that moment happen. That happened because of me, and that is empowering. Again, thank you guys. Thank you, Chatterbox. This is a great place. You have a good night.
Guys, keep it going for Pete. All right, a handful of storytellers left. We're going to do this quick. Put your hands together for Marina.
So just a quick disclaimer on this. My story tonight is going to deal with themes of suicide, so if that is something you are uncomfortable with, something that is triggering for you, please feel free to exit. No hard feelings. When I was 17 years old, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, type 2, and I would experience mostly depression at the time, but sometimes I would experience bouts of hypomania that manifested as extreme and irrational anger, and I would say and do things that I knew would hurt the people around me because I was in pain and I wanted someone else to be hurting too. And when I was 18 years old, after about half a semester of college, on November 5th, 2013, I took half a bottle of ibuprofen in the hopes that it would end my life. It didn't. And I very quickly regretted what I did, went to my roommate and was like, I just did this. His boyfriend got me to throw up the pills, and then they called the police and 911 and everything to get paramedics out there, make sure I was okay. And they took me to the hospital, cleared me medically, and I remember The police were the ones who had to take me to the hospital because they were the ones who had been called, and they're probably one of the worst moments of my life took place in that car, because one of the officers, when we got to the hospital, got out, went into the emergency room to explain the situation, and the other officer stayed in the car with me to make sure that I, you know, wasn't going to hurt myself further. And he was an older man, probably about like late 50s, early 60s. And it was quiet for a moment. He said, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter who's in the hospital right now, and they don't know if she's going to make it, and you're throwing your life away. And I wanted to scream in that moment, because one thing that I feel like a lot of people don't understand is that when it comes to mental health, there's already so much shame associated with it. There's a culture of silence, if you're not supposed to talk about this, you're just supposed to deal with the pain by yourself until it just suddenly disappears one day, or so we hope. And I wanted to tell that officer, I would do anything to exchange my life for your daughter's, because she wants to be here and I don't. I didn't say that. I just put my head down and got through it. And the next morning, when my dad, I was living in Tucson at the time, and my dad drove down from here, and he came to pick me up, and I remember being so scared, because there had been so many incidents of me running away from home or saying or doing hurtful things as a teenager living at home, that I just thought, like, he's done, he's had it, he's, you know, going to disown me, he's going to kick me out. And I walk out into the lobby, and he's just standing there, and he smiles at me, and he says, it's okay, and I love you. And he hugs me. And conversely to how the night previous was before, that was one of the best moments of my life. I'm very lucky in that regard to have a father who is so supportive and understanding. He is a recovering alcoholic himself, so he knows that the path of recovery is not always a linear one. And in line with that, on June 11th of 2015, I tried to kill myself a second time. And there's this moment that you have after a first suicide attempt where you promise yourself this will never happen again, and then it happens again. And that's when you really have to look at your life and say, what am I doing that I keep hurting myself like this? And I realized with my first attempt, as much as I wanted to play the victim and be the hurt one in the situation, I was hurting so many people around me, not just with the attempt, but with all my behaviors leading up to it. I was blaming all of my problems on the people around me, telling them how much they had hurt me and not paying attention to any of the ways that I was hurting them. And so after that second attempt, I started to make some changes in my life. The first thing I did was dye my hair bright pink, because I'd wanted to do that for 15 years. And I had it bright pink for about 3.5 years and chopped it all off about 2 months ago. And getting to do that and starting to appreciate just these small things in life was a way of allowing myself to love myself that I hadn't experienced before. But the most important thing I did to love myself was to admit that I'm not always the victim and that I am not infallible and that I will make mistakes and I will hurt people. But the only way to do anything about that, to decrease that hurt in the world, is not to remove myself from the world, but to do better next time and to make those amends as well as you can if you're able to make those amends and to move forward and to do better. That is all we can ask of each other. And the thing is, Chatterbox has allowed me, I think, in a lot of ways to do better because it allows me to share this story with other people who may need to hear it. And it has allowed me to hear stories that I've needed to hear. And the thing is, we all have stories that we have survived. Every single one of us has something traumatic and awful and heartbreaking in our past. But until we are willing to share those, we might as well just be alone. So I just want to say thank you to Jesse, to Esteban, to Sammy, to Jared, to Sean, to everyone who comes to these events, who you know, whether you heard about it from the start, you jumped in halfway, or you came last week and were like, I'm going to come to the one. You're here and you're sharing things and you're making people more connected. And that's how we survive. The only way we can survive this world is love. So thank you.
Stop making me cry. All right, guys, help me welcome Will Hightower.
Thank you. I'm here. You can stop clapping.
Hello, and welcome. My name is Will. Some of you, if you were here over the summer, you may remember me as like the guy who exclusively talked about his divorce. The one person, thank you. I would love to stand up here and tell you that like through the year of doing Chatterbox and really being up here and like talking about my divorce in a form of like public therapy and like vindication that I'm better now and not bitter, I would love to be able to tell you that, but I can't. So I've decided that I'm just not going to talk about it. I'm just not going to talk about my divorce. Not even going to bring it up at this point anymore. Which would be pretty great. But, let's see. Oh yeah. I want to thank Jesse first. Thank you so much. Thanks, Jesse. What a year. This has just been like I moved downtown last year because divorce. And I immediately started coming to Chatterbox because I was like, where's all the broken people? And then I found them. I found them here at Chatterbox. And what a year. It was a great year. I went away for a while after I was doing a lot of the Chatterbox over the summer, and then I went away for a little bit to do some more traditional theater. And some of you thought I killed myself, and... I tried, but didn't go very well. I did the same, very similar things. And I'm just glad that this is a venue for people to talk about those things. So, that's it for the sad stuff that I've got. Okay. So empowerment, essentially, what would the white man do? That's pretty much all you have to think of when you think of empowerment. What would the white man do in this situation? Make a smoothie. That's what would happen. So you think, what would the white man do? And then you do that, and then you somehow are empowered, right? My father used to say about power, and Hollywood in general, he would say, it's all about who you know and who you blow. So I'm here to tell you tonight to empower yourself, to therefore blow yourself. Tonight, each and every one of you, I want you to go home and blow yourself tonight, okay? This is what we're going to do. So like some of the other people that we heard stories here tonight, I grew up in a broken home. Divorce. Not mine, though, so it doesn't count. I grew up in a broken home, and when I lived with my mother, I was, like, homeless for a lot of the time, and it was, like, pretty exciting because you're a kid, and you're just, like, walking around the railroad tracks and, like, singing with your imaginary friends. But because it was, like, when you're in that situation, you're, like, danger's out there. So then you feel safe, like, inside your body. But then when the police got involved and I started to live with my father, and then I was like, oh, danger's at home. And I found different ways to get out. One of those ways when I was in middle school was the middle school wrestling team. Yes, just like a bunch of like 12, 13-year-old dudes in like tight singlets. I should have just went straight to theater. This was amazing. And the first year on the wrestling team, I went undefeated because I didn't wrestle a single person. And you'd have to wrestle in order to lose. The second year, though, because someone broke their wrist and I had to be varsity, I had to wrestle a lot of people, and I lost every single one of those matches. And I was like, just trying to get through it. There's just so many, like, just dicks everywhere. It's terrible. But like someone said earlier, there's so much more to overcome, right? Like there's the dicks in your life when you're a kid, and then there's like dicks in your life when you're an adult, and you will overcome on those dicks. Let's see. Oh, Chatterbox. This is another thank you note. Chatterbox helped me rediscover who I was after my divorce. Because you kind of lose touch with yourself in a way, right? Another thing someone else said was, if you wait till you're ready, you'll never be ready, and you'll never do it. Okay, so basically what I'm trying to say is you don't know what doing that thing is going to do later, right? When I was like 15 or 16, I was like studying for finals, and my father had made like a habit, I guess, out of like attacking my sister and I. And so I was like 15 or 16 at this point. So then he attacked me. He grabbed me from behind and I threw that fucker over my shoulder, like out of instinct, out of wrestling move, hip toss. I was like, boom, boom. He stopped fucking with me after that. So sometimes you have to lose for 2 years, go 1 year undefeated. You have to lose for a year and deal with a bunch of teenage dicks. So your father stops fucking with you. But I'm here to tell you really just like do the thing, make mistakes, fail, but safely fail, try things. I was in a storytelling class at community college and this older woman stood up. She was just taking it for like continuing education or she was just old. She was at the community college and she stood up and she said, did I mention community college? She said, I wish I had made more mistakes. Right. And hearing that from like she was like 1,000. Hearing that from her just like shook me. I was like 19, just like shook me to my core. I was like, oh, wow, I spent too much time trying to be perfect. And this woman's saying that she wished she made more mistakes. She probably freaky. So I'm trying to say that there's no like coronation ceremony, there's no graduation ceremony for being a storyteller or a leader or an artist or a community organizer. There's no ceremony for that. It's the day that you get up and decide to do the thing. So I just want to say, just go out there and do the thing and let yourself fail because you're never going to know your impact, right? For a couple of years, maybe like 5 or 6 years, I talked about my depression and anxiety and suicides and thing online. And you never know what impact that's going to make. Because of that, for some reason, people finding that stuff all over the world, a guy has a tattoo on his arm. There's something that I wrote, and it just said that it'll never be enough. That's what I wrote. And I asked him, I said, it will never be enough. Does that remind you that no matter how much you work, it will never be enough, so you should work harder? Or no matter how much you do, it'll never be enough, so you should take it easy? And he said, it depends on the day. And I was like, that's a good answer. Okay. All right. So my last thing here, which I lost. Oh, my last thing is just to do the thing. You've got something in your head that you're waiting on doing. right? You're like, oh man, I want to start an open mic storytelling event that takes place in the corner of a already kind of small and busy cafe. People are going to tell you you're crazy. But you never know what impact that's going to have on people. So go out there. There's two things I want you to do. One, I want you to start your own chatterbox. You can't call it chatterbox, though. You got to call it Battercocks. I already own Battercocks.com, so don't. That's mine. You don't get that one. But I want you to go home. Take the first step. The first tiniest baby step, like in Jeff Cardello's story, take the smallest step that you can at this point in your life, rehabilitating yourself, physical therapy, artistic therapy, take that first step and blow yourself, empower yourself. Thank you.
Guys, keep it going for Will. I feel like it should be like Will Hightower 2020, do the thing. Like that's your whole slogan is built around doing the thing. All right, guys, we have a familiar face to the stage. And then very briefly, Sammy, Estefan, and I will just cry in unison in the microphone to end the show. It'll be cooler than that. Put your hands together for our podcast producer, Jared.
Thank you. I'm not sure I know so much about empowerment, but I know about fuck it. And fuck it is what got me to start doing the thing. As wherever Will went said. And so it's what got me to start, you know, talking or to stop talking about sending my writing out and to actually do that and then to go ahead and get published. And then it's what stopped me, you know, like talking about or thinking about doing something creative with my life and got me to start doing podcasting and then also publishing other people's work. And it's, you know, it's what got me to talk to Jessie about having her show be on my fledgling podcast network. But fuck it is very different from fuck that shit. And fuck that shit is a defense. Fuck that shit is what basically led me to feel like, you know, what I had to say about stuff didn't matter. Nobody wanted to hear anything that I had to say. And it's an armor, it's a shell. And it's basically, that's the thing that's kind of led me to be 36 and having just been broken up with by my longtime girlfriend and being in a one bedroom apartment by myself with my cat. Who's very opinionated, and is the longest most functional relationships I've had in my life are with cats, mostly because they don't put up with my shit, and people have been telling some really affecting stories tonight, and I really toyed with the idea of just talking for 4 minutes about like Avengers Endgame spoilers, but. I recently, like I said, I'm 36 years old. I just started going to therapy for the first time, and I should have gone a long time ago. But it's one of those things where I was like, fuck that shit. And that's like other people who don't know how to deal with their own stuff. But it turns out I don't know how to deal with my own stuff. And I just was, you know, I was going to this thing and doing all the intake stuff and talking to the lady. And I kept sitting forward like this, like the entire time. I do podcasting. I know that visual cues don't work on podcasting, but it's I was just ready to go. Like I was ready for things to not work, for me to say fuck this shit and just go. And you know, a couple of months into it, The therapist diagnosed me as being as having PTSD, and so I sat back, and was like, "Well, in my head," and I ended up saying it out loud, was like, "That's not for people. That's like for soldiers and shit. That's not for me. I don't, you know." I just minimize everything, and it turns out that I'm dealing with some actual trauma. I guess I just said fuck it to that. And I'm like, all right, I'm ready to deal with my shit. And I was like, fuck it to, you know, not just being open about things anymore. And I'm just talking through everything. I'm up here. I'm talking about this now. I do my podcast. I talk about it at the beginning. And I thought that nobody would want to hear anything like that. And it's been like this really over the last 3-4 years that I've been doing my podcast. I've gotten a bunch of feedback. I used to apologize. I would tell some story, something that I was going through, and then I'd be like, oh, you guys don't want to hear this. I would say on mic to nobody. I didn't even know if people were listening. I'm like, you don't want to hear this. And I started getting like emails and feedback and everything, and people telling me that me talking about what I was going through and how I was dealing with things was helpful to them. And I guess I'm telling that story because I feel like that's what this was for me too. And that to hear people being, you know, just kind of open and vulnerable was really helpful at this stage in my life for me to feel like I could do the same. And so thank you, Jesse and Esteban and everybody. And that's it.
Guys, we didn't have quite enough time to have Sammy, myself, and Jesse share some stories, but we are going to take a couple minutes to. We're gonna take a couple minutes to say some things, and then we're all going to head over to down the street to Wilderness, Arizona Wilderness, for some drinks and hang out with you guys, and maybe we can share some more there. But real quick. It's rare that I get to introduce my best friend before a big audience, so I just want to take a second to thank this person for supporting me and coming to every show she could and being one of the reasons that I look forward to being here so much. So please help me welcome Sammy.
Hello. Okay. Hi, everyone. Really quick, can I just, everybody give a round of applause for all of the storytellers that have come out tonight. You are all so amazing. And being a part of this incredible community has just meant so much to me. I have been so moved by so many stories throughout my like year and a half of coming to Chatterbox, and especially tonight, I feel like I've resonated with so many stories. 3 words. There are 3 words that have helped me to find my own personal empowerment. And those 3 words are feel it all. I am a very sensitive person. And for a large majority of my life, I have had people from family, friends, colleagues, people that kind of sort of know me a little, tell me, you're too sensitive. You need to just kind of get over it. Like, you're overreacting. You're being so dramatic. And, you know, I was always ashamed to feel the way that I feel. I was ashamed of expressing myself. I was ashamed of it. And I kind of started to kind of crawl back into my own self and not try to express those things. And people who know me know I'm pretty much an open book, I'm sure. I can't really hide my emotions very well. I am pretty open about a lot of things. But I have been incredibly insecure about myself for a very long time, especially because of my sensitivity and of being told that I'm too dramatic and that I'm overthinking things and that I just need to shut up, forget about it, have a shot, and like move the fuck on. And something that has really, really helped me is those three words, feel it all. I feel things in the biggest capacity possible. When I'm happy, I am overjoyed. Everything is amazing. I can conquer the world. And when I feel down, it feels as though I need to be dragged into the very bottommost pits of hell because I deserve it. And those kind of feelings of just constant back and forth, that ebb and flow of, you're great, you're horrible, you're awesome, go die. Like, it's so much to handle, and it drives me kind of insane. And the people around me who love me and care about me have also been driven insane by that at some points, I'm sure. But I have really come to realize that there is nothing wrong with feeling how I feel. There is nothing wrong with owning my emotions in every moment that I have them. If I'm angry, I can be angry, and that's okay. If I'm happy, I can be overjoyed, and that's okay. It's taken me 22 years to realize that me being sensitive is not a detriment to who I am. It's not a detriment to those around me. It is something that is a strength. Because when I'm so happy and I want to just share that with people, I can feel it. When I'm happy and I tell people, you look great today, or hey, I love you, you're fantastic, or I hope you have an awesome day, you're doing great, I see the smiles that come from people's faces, and I see just a little bit of a light up, and it reminds me that it is okay to feel everything. And I would so much rather feel everything than feel nothing. I used to drown myself with all kinds of stuff and think that I needed to put myself into this dark box, not feel anything. But there's nothing wrong with just feeling it all. And that's what's empowered me the most. And I really quick, of course, want to say a huge thank you to this community, to Jesse, to Esty, to Sean, to everyone who has made this community what it is. I'm so thankful to you all because you've helped me to realize that feeling it all is totally okay. So thank you.
Guys, keep it going for Sammy. All right. There's two more quick stories left. We're going to run the clock, so when the show is done, the cafe is closed, so we're going to need your help putting the furniture back. There are five-ish of us that know how that looks, so we will help you. We need your help, though, and your sexy manpower. Thank you. All right, guys. Our next storyteller is my wonderful co-host. I am a stubborn asshole and thought that I could do this show by myself for as long as I did, and I drove myself crazy. You did not just make that sound at me. He knows because it's true, because I'd have like a meltdown before he's like, it's okay, just ask someone to help. Oh, that's bullshit. And I did ask someone to help, and it was the best decision I made because I needed it. And I needed someone that was going to reinvigorate the show when I needed it the most, to bring in your friends and community and your wonderful storytelling to be a part of this. Put your hands together for Estevan.
Stop making me cry. I just wanted to take a minute. I never expected to be able to come here and find a home. I was introduced to it by my friend Alexis when I was going through a bit of a dry spell and kind of out of ideas and was lacking any type of creativity. And so she brought me out to Chatterbox. And I listened to Jesse and I listened to all the other storytellers that night. And I thought to myself, damn, I want to do that. And so I started coming every single week. I told probably a couple weeks later when Jesse came up and she's like, I've seen you here a couple of times. Here, put your name on the list. You're telling. And I was like, neat. And I told. And I didn't realize that I would actually feel comfortable up here. And then a couple of months later, Jesse asked me to be her co-host. And I said, well, I've never co-hosted a thing ever, so I don't know how this is going to go. And she's like, let's do it. And I was like, okay. And I got up here and I would apologize almost every week, like, hey, I'm socially awkward. Like, I don't know what I'm doing up here, but let's introduce the next person. And I would stammer on my words and I wouldn't know what to say. And now it's so ingrained on Wednesday to kind of hype myself up and like, all right, it's showtime. But the thing is, Chatterbox never wholly belonged to the Chatter crew, never wholly belonged to Jesse, never wholly belonged to me or Sammy or any of the people that helped. Chatterbox is all of you guys. So this isn't the end of the story. It's just the end of a chapter. And hopefully we are the forward in all of your guys' stories that you can go out and keep creating your own and keep sharing your stories. Come back, hit us up. We're here anytime. Be happy to listen to what you guys come up with next. Thank you very much. And now the really smug look, because usually I give this next person a really long introduction, but I'll hold most of it. I will just say, help me please welcome the hostess with the mostest, the reason why we are all here, the person who led by example and created a community based off of the values that she holds high. Please help me welcome Jessie.
This is the last one, guys. Holy shit. I never thought I'd be here. I never really thought about the end of Chatterbox. But like Estevan said, it isn't really about me. It was about everyone that came to make this show what it is, because Estevan and I can only tell each other so many stories before that gets really boring. I'm going to do like it's an acceptance speech. Like, I'm just going to thank a bunch of people, if that's cool with you guys. Because if I do that, then I won't cry, probably. I have a lot of people to thank for this. The biggest person that I could thank are the storytellers that got me into storytelling. And that is Dan Hull and Rachel Egboro. If you guys grab that yellow sheet of paper that has all the other storytelling shows on it, someone hold it up if you've got one. Cool. Those shows are on there that they run. One is the Storyline Slam at the Newton. The other one is The Whole Story at the Phoenix Art Museum. And those are wonderful shows. But those two people inspired me to be the storyteller that I am and asked me to be a part of something that I had no idea I could do about 5 years ago now. And it turned into this. And me running this show by myself for as long as I did, I met a lot of wonderful people, and I am very thankful for the opportunity to have help, to fail graciously and have people be like, you could probably use some assistance with that. And I never thought that I'd find this community here. I'm not the kind of person that really, I don't see myself fitting in a lot of places. Not because I don't want to or not because I'm not trying, but because I think I'm a little bit of all kinds of things. I'm more of like a chameleon person. Like, I'm this friend with this group of people and this friend with this group of people. And in Phoenix, all of those scenes just didn't fit me all of the way. And I wanted to fit. And storytelling is where I fit. And it's with people like you. And half of you I don't know, and I love that. Strangers. And I clearly didn't learn what my parents told me about not talking to strangers, because it's my favorite thing. Because strangers have the best stories and the best candy. Thank you guys so much for making this possible. Thank you for making it worth my while every week to be here and to do this. It helped me through a lot of really hard times, personal stuff that I had to deal with and go through on my own, because I knew that I could come every Wednesday and see a group of wonderful, smiling, amazing people in my community who just gave a shit. And that was awesome. And it felt great. And it still feels great, and I will definitely miss this feeling. It is very bittersweet, but it's necessary because, you know, like a handful of people up here have already said seasons for change is what's happening now. And I'm in that time of my life as well, and things need to be different, and it doesn't need to be better because this is the best it's going to be, I think, for me, but different. So thank you for coming out tonight on our final show. Thank you for telling. Thank you for listening. All of our podcasts will be available until whoever, whenever, who knows. Those podcasts are available everywhere. If you want to be friends with Estevan and I, we will gladly accept your friendship. There's an application we can give you. We have a panel interview situation going on. No. But yeah, I hope we can stay in touch. I will still be in Phoenix. I'm not going anywhere crazy. But yeah, let me know if you want to get a cup of coffee or hang out. After the show, we're heading over to Arizona Wilderness Brewery, which is right down the street. If you guys want to come hang out, we have a giant memory board. So if you want to share some memories or write some well wishes to the show, we'll do that there as well. But thank you so much. And thank you, Fairtrade Cafe, for giving us the space. Thank you, Jared, for recording the show. Thank you, Jeff, for DJing us in today. Thank you, everyone. Have a great night.
This has been a Hoon Waddle production. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out one of our other fine podcasts available from hootandwaddle.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any number of podcast apps. If you'd like to support Hoot and Waddle and get access to an exclusive member-only podcast, receive discounts on merch, and more, go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle. We'll be right back.